We're going to get into this cathodic microphone mating season here. I got to remember not to walk too far over that way. God has my helper. She's going to fix me up. I shouldn't say helper. My technical person is going to straighten out what I just messed up. That's what she's going to do. All right? Everybody can hear that. Anyway, talking about Uncle Noon, we told my yesterday, if y'all remember, him and his wife, Aunt Mess. Now, like I told y'all, I didn't tell y'all about Aunt Mess yesterday, but I'm going to tell y'all about Aunt Mess today. Her face is just like her name. Somebody once asked her mama if she was born ugly or if she's like the rest of us and got ugly as she got older, you know. She said, no, she was born ugly. In fact, we had to put a pork chopper on her neck so the dog would play with her, you know. But Uncle Noon, he saved up some money. Well, he didn't really save it up. I'm going to tell the truth here. He won the lottery, a little bit of money. Not the big jackpot, but, you know, won a little money. And he decided he want to do something for her. And he decided he'd take her to them plastic surgeons. Because, you know, she got some of them wrinkles. Somebody said it looked like a fish caught on fire and they put it out with a rake. They went out there to them plastical surgeon. They got up way up north. Way up north around Shreveport. And they went up there and the plastical surgeon said, well, I'm going to have to examine her. He said, okay. So I examined her and pokey prod and checked. He said, Noon, I think we can help her out. He said, well, what you going to do? He said, I think we ought to start with her nose. He said, well, what you going to do? Make it smaller? Straighten it out? He said, I think we ought to start by putting it between her two eyes. But this morning, I'm going to try to put a little information between your two ears. On cathodic protection, and maybe we'll have a little fun with it too. cathodic protection, of course, and here's my picture again. We don't want to get too much of that, but you know, it's just on you. Okay, that's my name, address, and all that stuff. Y'all got those evaluations before we leave here today. I appreciate you do fill those out. And just to repeat a little bit on that, if you put down what you like, and if there's something you'd like to see in the future that we didn't do this time around, I'd like to see that too. That really helps us out. So I'd appreciate what you can do on that. Again, my email address for those of you that might want to send an email. I got a call at 6 o'clock this morning from Atlanta. Guy with a question. He didn't realize I'm in the mountains on it, but you know, that's just the way it is. Bless you.
Thank you.
Hey, if God sneezes, what do you say?
Bless you.
Really?
I don't know.
I was wondering that the other day. No, I was driving that big old motor home and all of a sudden had a big old gust of wind, you know. And I go, God must have sneezed, but I don't know what to say. Because it just came out of nowhere. I mean, there was a pretty good blast. Cathodic protection and corrosion. Well, let's look at a little bit of history. We got BC. Y'all familiar with that BC before corrosion? And anyway, BC, you know, back in the day, they prized the gold a lot. And you know, that's one thing about it. If you made all your pipelines out of gold, they'd never rust, right? See, that's all you got to do. That's a pretty simple answer. Just get them out there, make them out of gold. But back yonder, they started finding ways to produce metals, and they used copper and bronze. And, you know, it's pretty malleable, easy to work with, smelt easily. So they discovered steel, the Spartans did. And, back then, I don't think they ever did discover their secret recipe for the steel they used to use in their swords and things like that, because it really, really highly prized their swords. They're really quality. They killed a lot of folks with them too. But the Romans pretty much used just plain iron, where the Spartans were using steel. Now they use them not only for the swords, but they use them for the ship bottoms, kind of to clad the ship bottoms, and they use them for tools. Now around 1824, We had a fellow named Humphrey Davy. In fact, he became a knight because of this. He developed a methodology or realized this, that you could protect these iron-bottom ships. And some of them were copper-bottom ships, by utilizing another type of material, what we would call an anode, and we'll learn more about that in just a minute, to protect the bottom of these ships. Because they would take on water and sink because the metals would corrode. A lot of people think copper doesn't corrode, but we'll talk about that in just a minute, too. But basically, he came out with using zinc anodes back in 1824 to protect these ships, okay? 1924, a fellow named Evans. It wasn't Bob Evans. Who talked about Bob Evans this morning? There's no Bob Evans in this state, is there? Restaurant? Oh, my Lord. Let me tell you what. If you ever had a Bob Evans mixed biscuit, I'll tell you. This Indiana and Illinois, right, partner? That Bob Evans biscuit, that's just... It's wonderful. I highly recommend it. Anyway, enough about Evans. There's another Evans. There ain't no kinfolk or nothing. Basically, he came up with a description of the process of electrochemical corrosion of metal. We'll kind of see how that fits in here in a minute. But now we know something about the history. Let's talk about what it is and what it ain't. Now, as we can see here, folks, corrosion, what it ain't. Now, some people believe this stuff, but this is an unretouched photograph right here of ohmites. I don't know how many of y'all got ohmites on your pipeline. Now, them ohmites are, they're eating up your pipeline. They run up and down chewing on it. And we put that CP, cathodic protection, that electricity, onto the pipeline to kill the ohmites and keep it from rusting. Any questions? Okay, well, maybe not. Maybe it's something else. That'd be nice if it was. We'd go out there and gather up the ohmites. Basically, though, corrosion is metal deteriorating. And it's not just steel or iron. It's any metal that can deteriorate. And basically, what happens here is a result of where it is. In certain cases, the atmosphere, like you get the Titanic. You seen one that did all that stuff with Titanic. They brought that, went down there and took pictures of it. It looked pretty good, didn't it? Why do you think it didn't all rust away by now? It probably isn't a lot of oxygen, and it's probably very cold out there. We'll see in a minute that plays a big part on why that particular atmosphere in that particular seawater did cause it to corrode, okay, simply put. So there's some other things going in there, but basically it's a reaction that causes the metal to deteriorate, and basically what it's trying to do is go back to what it used to be, like the ore that it used to be. Because what happens when you process a metal, an alloy, things of this nature, you put a lot of energy into that thing. What it's trying to do is release that energy and go back to being that ore. And that's when we see this iron oxide or rust, okay? Another thing is the galvanic corrosion of metal that occurs when you got one metal that's different from another, okay? One is more positive or negative in relationship to each other. Sometimes it's the same piece of metal, but in different areas. You know, if you made a piece of pipe, it's not homogeneous always throughout the whole deal. So sometimes you can have actually the same piece of pipe where you have a corrosion on it. Now let's take a look at that process where we can understand a little bit clearer. Let's get down a little more simple nuts and bolts on the thing. Like I said, it's trying to revert to back to its naturally occurring forms here. Steel revert back to iron oxide, which is the way it was found in the earth, maybe in Pennsylvania or wherever they dug up the stuff, okay? But an alloy pretty much is trying to revert back to. And it can be not just one, a metal, two metals, but it can be a metal and a non-metal. Now let's take a look at iron, okay? Here's the iron atom. Now basically, what we have in the process that iron, the atom loses two electrons, and we're not going to get too far off into this because I know some of you don't give a damn, really. But I just want you to have some kind of comprehension of the simplicity of the process, not getting into a bunch of... How many corrosion engineers do I have here, by the way? Nation qualified people. Oh, man, come on here, take this damn thing. Gee, because it's you know, if you get 10 NACE engineers or corrosion people in the same room, do any of them agree? No. They all have kind of a different idea on the thing. And when I was in the pipeline, we used to think it was some kind of magical thing. You know, those old boys just drove around a truck and didn't do anything. They'd put a little bag or something on the pipeline, or maybe go turn a knob or something like that, and go, well, what'd you do? Well, we're protecting the pipeline. Yeah, right. I dug the bell hole, you know? Anyway, it's an electrical process where you actually, iron ions and free electrons are being given off and received. Here we see a kind of a deal where it's an oxidation reduction reaction, basically, where you can see this chunks of this piece of iron are being lost. And basically, this is losing electrons from the iron, and that's when you're going to get that pit, and then it's going to go all the way through the wall of the pipe after it gets eaten away, and then it'll have you'll have a leak. And basically, it's gone over and gone to a cathode. Now, what we're talking about is simply put here, cathodic protection, as you saw in that picture we just saw. There's some hydrogen that is produced, and it forms a thin layer of hydrogen on the pipeline. Hydrogen is going to the pipeline, okay? Now, how many of you have heard of hydrogen stress cracking? In other words, that hydrogen is what you're worried about getting into the metal, or maybe there's some cracks or minor flaws there, or hard spots or something like that hydrogen can get into, causing brittlement or hydrogen cracking. So you know that hydrogen is going there. We coat the pipeline, of course, trying to protect it from rusting, right? We coat it also, as part of the cathodic protection process. What we're looking at is a basic cell here, and I think I'm going to bring this to you in a simpler way as far as the anode and the cathode. One is giving up parts of itself to protect the other, and that's what we're doing with cathodic protection. We're utilizing materials to protect the pipeline. We want to protect the pipeline. We don't want the pipeline to get beat up. We have four parts of a cathodic protection cell, basically the anode, the cathode, of course, the electrical circuit, and of course, the electrolyte. Now, the electrolyte, in our case, is going to be the soil, okay? The pipeline carrying the current. Now, four parts, like I said again, metallic return path, the anode, the cathode, and the electrolyte. Or you could call it MACE if you want to. But let's take a look at this a little closer. Remember, the cathode is the area that's being protected. In our case, the pipeline, okay? It's receiving those electrons. The anode is what's sacrificing itself. So when you hear somebody talking about a magnesium anode or a ground bed made of anodes, that's what's getting eat up. That's what we want to protect our pipeline. That's what we want. It's cheaper than replacing a pipeline to replace these anodes. Now, the metallic return path, of course, any piece of metal that connects the anode and the cathode and the electrolyte, in our case, can be soil, can be salt water, can be lake water, whatever. Could be body fluids, but you'd have to have a lot of it. This is a basic corrosion cell. What is this? A battery. Yeah, what they call a dry cell alkaline battery. And basically, it's a good example of a corrosion cell. I'm trying to get this a little clearer picture for those of you who don't deal with it. Basically, our anode is powdered zinc up here in the middle. Okay, that's what's going to be sacrificed. The cathode, magnesium dioxide carbon in this particular case. We have electrolyte, that potassium hydroxide, that paste that's up inside of that thing. You've had a battery leak on you? Okay, you know what I'm talking about there. And basically, a battery such as this is a corrosion cell. And in effect, you can say a corrosion cell is a battery. And there's a flow of current through the circuit. Because really, a battery just sits there, right? Does it do anything just sitting there? Not until you put it into a circuit. Remember that electrical path? And then you flip on the switch. Until you flip on the switch, you don't have a complete circuit. So So that's what we're talking about as far as cathodic protection also. You have to have a complete circuit. You have to have those four things that we talked about. Now, if you get them extra life batteries, basically they just have thicker cases on them, okay? All right. Now, I only put this here because we're going to see here in a minute that copper, in its relationship to other metals, a lot of people think, well, I'm going to use copper because, I mean, you know, copper is not going to corrode. We can put copper, it's going to make the house pretty or make the whatever we're doing pretty, you know, and they think, well, copper is not going to corrode. Well, that's a misnomer. It's a myth. And I just use this to let you know that all metals will corrode. And if you've got some houses, maybe where your piping, if you have metal piping that comes in contact with copper, or maybe for some reason you have connections of copper to steel or iron, okay, you'll find out that your steel or iron will sacrifice itself to protect the copper. Okay, you don't want. You know, right. You're absolutely right. And that's what we're going to see. There's ways to stop this from happening. We see that, and we'll look a little closer at this in a minute. But you remember, we're talking about anodes, and on a pipeline, we oftentimes use these magnesium or zinc anodes. I'm sure many of you hear about that. And that's what we use a lot of times to protect the pipeline, which is made of iron, steel, in this category. Anything higher protects anything lower. So we can see that a steel line would protect a copper line. It's just an example also. And that steel line is giving up metal and will begin to leak after a while and protect that copper. But there are other metals that can be used in relationship to that. So we have three choices in this particular case. We're using copper as an example. We can use a metal rather than copper that steel doesn't sacrifice itself to, okay? We can use plastic, as some of you said yesterday. Man, the good thing about plastic is we don't have to have cathodic protection. We don't have corrosion. Or we can use isolated or insulated, as she said just a minute ago. We can insulate the two from touching each other and keep that from happening. Here's an insulator right here. Okay. So we electrically separate it by insulating. Now, sometimes we can slow down the process. I mentioned to you about the Titanic earlier. We see here a reference to where a white car battery fails in the winter. You know, I don't know about you, but I've been putting my batteries in the freezer for a long time. People told me to do that in film and something. I guess they say it slows down any chemical process. But I'm like you. It's not in the circuit, so what's the deal? But I do it anyway because somebody said it was good. You know what it is. But keeping batteries and film in a freezer, they said they'll last a lot longer. So I just do it. They may be right. They may be wrong. It doesn't hurt a bit. Anyway, I like to feel the cold batteries in my hand. How about you? Okay. I guess that wasn't me. But anyway, the thing about it in relationship to what you guys got, the same, like I said, the Titanic and things of this nature, even on the moon, there's no corrosion. And one of the things is the temperature. And that's why, do you think it's a good idea to take pack of salt readings in January? Probably not a good idea because the temperatures are cold. So it's probably slowing down that process of cathodic protection, so you're not getting the highest readings like you would in the summer month. And of course, it's always good to have moisture too. When do you take your cathodic protection reading, partner? May? It's May, June, good time of the year. It's kind of warmed up and everything. Yeah. Okay. Now, as far as the code is concerned, of course, we have a few regulations that deal with cathodic protection. You all may have noticed. I hope you did. Anyway, what we're looking at here, of course, is protecting the pipeline from external, internal, and atmospheric corrosion. We see that galvanic series of metals that we talked about earlier. And basically what we're saying is some of these metals are more noble or more negative in potential. Some are more, what they call the noble metals, are more positive in their potential. So the more negative, like magnesium and zinc, protect the iron, which is less negative on this series, this galvanic series. This series actually comes from history, and was a lot of it was developed by our old friend Sir Humphrey Davies when he was developing that stuff for those ships. It comes from the Greek word for way up on, and in our case is way up on this list, and the anodes, and the cathodic, or cathodes, or cathodos for Greek, way down. So basically, this is where they come get those terms from. Now, let me, we've got Ed Ondack. Anybody know Ed Ondack here? He used to be the chief out of the western region, I think central region for a while. Ed's been about everything you can think of, but he is an expert in cathodic protection and puts on our, he's one with Frank Rizzo that you heard Mr. Steiner refer to yesterday, putting on our cathodic protection training for our inspectors. And I put a few little short snippets of video with Ed explaining the galvanic series of metals. So let me just turn this over to Ed for about 30 seconds here. Keep an eye on the reading on the meter here.
This demonstration will depict the galvanic series of metals. In this case, I'm going to be using copper as our reference. We're using copper basically as the textbook uses it. In the field, we use a copper sulfate electrode, which we'll explain later in the module. We'll go first to our number one, which is the steel. Notice the voltmeter reading itself for the steel. You'll also notice that steel is negative with respect to copper. We have a negative lead from the voltmeter, going to the negative here, positive being the reference electrode here.
0.44.
We next go to the galvanized metal. Notice the reading.
0.884.
From the galvanized, we'll go to the magnesium anode.
1.9.
Notice again the reading. Notice how high. Now, of course, the theory being that anything that's high negative will corrode to anything that is less negative. Therefore, this will corrode to copper. This will corrode to copper. Magnesium will corrode. Now, when we move to zinc, notice also its high reading, which means it will corrode also to the copper. And we'll move to the piece of old rusty pipe. And we'll move to the lead. And now watch the meter as we go to the platinum niobium wire. Notice the polarity change. Polarity change meaning that now this is now cathodic to the copper.
So the copper would sacrifice itself to protect the platinum. Okay. So you can build a pipeline out of platinum, too. Okay. Good. Well, it's good to know these new metals y'all can use. I guarantee you, gold, platinum. Very good. Okay. So, in effect, we have our iron pipe or steel pipe in the ground. We have our electrolyte, our soil. We have our, we saw a meter being used here. And we're going to look at what these tools are in just a minute. Meter, copper sulfate reference electrode, what's called a half cell. We'll check that out in just a minute. But what we're trying to do by using these anodes or ground beds is another thing we can use. As we're trying to change that polarity, we're trying to get what's called a polarization, and we're trying to change that to a point to where we have one, we're making it, we're forcing it to be more negative or more positive so they reach a happy medium is what we're trying to get to, what I call a happy medium. So you got a happy pipe, right? Well, yeah, you seen the little ohmites? They're not too happy. Now, like I said, a metallic pass could be on the same joint or pipe. One area on it could be cathodic to another area because a dissimilar type of homogeneous is not homogeneous in mixture. Other things that can cause corrosion on pipeline, like I said, you could have that steel, copper, where you have a different metal that's in connection with it, or some other type of metal. Or perhaps you got two different types of steel. Maybe you've got some old pipe. You remember when they had an old rusty pipe there, and then you drop in a new piece of pipe? Another one's looking at the other as which one is going to sacrifice to the other. So you have a situation also sometimes in dissimilar soils. You have compaction in the soil. Maybe that's not as much air, oxygen for that oxidation reduction reaction there. A differential aeration. Situation, like I said, down the bottom where the pipeline is laying on the ground as compared to the soil that's up on top, how it was backfilled. Mill scale corrosion, things of this nature, a variety of corrosion on pipelines. Another thing that affects us, of course, is realizing that resistance of the soil can have an effect on corrosivity. Whereas if you're below, in this area, you're very corrosive. Where you go to high resistance here, it's mildly corrosive. And this fits into play just like any other circuit or electrical circuit where you have high resistance. It's going to affect the voltage. And we're looking for voltage, and we'll talk about the criteria in just a minute. Soil pH, of course, whether it's acid or alkaline, this, of course, can affect them, whether or not you're going to have corrosion on the metal. That plays a big part. In some cases, I'm not sure of the soil conditions you have here. Basically, what we're trying to do is with cathodic protection is to mitigate, the corrosion. We're trying to force current to flow in a certain direction from solution or from the electrolyte or soil. We use galvanic sock. Anybody using galvanic anodes here? Anybody? Okay, we'll look a little bit. You are? Okay. Galvanic sacrificial anodes, basically, what we talked about, maybe magnesium or zinc, just tied to the pipeline electrically by wire, buried in there with the pipeline, and it's protecting the pipeline as such. Impressed current system, where we need to protect more pipe, we want to kind of put a hump behind the thing, so we're actually utilizing usually AC current that's changed to DC. Utilizing a rectifier and pushing this stuff. And usually a ground bed is incorporated in this. How many of you using ground beds to protect the pipeline? Okay, several of you. Okay. That was a picture of one of these sacks. And these things are not just a sack. They're specially built as the materials are in them are put together in a certain manner. Because you want the thing to last a long time. You don't want it to all get eat up at where the wire is coming into the deal. You don't want it to be disconnected or anything like this. You want this thing to last as long as possible to protect your pipeline. You can see here what usually occurs on in some of these old pipelines is they have a leak, and it's caused by corrosion. So when they go in and put a clamp on there and put a permanent repair, right? They drop in a mag anode that they call a magnesium anode a lot of times because of the high potential of that packaged magnesium anode. Galvanic anode system we see here, like I said, they just drop moist soil. You have to give this stuff time now. Plus, there's some requirements of distance depending on whether it's magnesium or zinc. But basically, like I said, it is dropped in usually after a leak is found. Like I say, in this case, we see the impressed current utilizing the AC power going to a rectifier, changing that to DC to actually drive current to protect this pipeline. There's a rectifier and installation of the anodes. Now, the code requires under 192.453 that you have this being done under the direction of a person that's qualified in pipeline corrosion control methods. Okay? Now this is a little bit different than OQ qualified person. OQ requires that an unqualified person must be under the direct supervision. In other words, they can see you and maybe take over for you if you're doing it wrong. Whereas, like I said, the one before, the program and the people are under the direction, but not the actual necessarily line of sight view of this person. So there is a difference when we're talking about that qualification. Now, as far as your system is concerned, you need to maintain records. We talked about records before. You have to have not only the records of the tests and things, we'll talk about that in a minute, but you need to have information as to when this was installed, because there are certain dates in the code that require that the cathodic protection or be applied to certain pipelines depending on when they were built. Also, whether it's transmission or distribution or coated or bare pipeline. Now, here's some of the dates, and I'm not going to bore you with the specifics. It is in the code on the 455, 457. We're looking at, why do you think they have different dates, by the way, in the code? You ever notice that? In different parts of the code, there's like a list of dates. And you go, wow, transmission line need to be done this time, another line. Because the code changes, right? And when the code changes, they try to afford you to not penalize you. And they say, well, look, from this day forward, we're going to cover distribution lines. But we started transmission lines on this day forward. So that in the gathering lines that came out here a while back and things of this nature. So they're giving you a chance to get started with it, but not saying, you know, you got to go retroactively back on the deal. So that's why we see these dates for coated metallic pipelines, for coated transmission pipelines and station piping. Also, it's required for areas of active corrosion. We see a different date here. This talking about here on the 457B, you may have some of these bare or ineffectively coated pipelines. I know we used to have lines that we call cathodically bare pipelines because they were so old pipelines that were coated with, I don't know if any of you ever heard of something called Barrett's Primer. It is like they take what they call a granny rag back in the 30s and something like that, and it was just like a rag. They dip it in this liquid and kind of wash the pipe with this stuff. It kind of discolored it a little bit, and they call that a coating. Okay? And that's why we call it cathodically bare pipe, because that wasn't worth a darn, you see? So sometimes you have ineffectively coated transmission pipelines like that, station piping, be it bare or coated, and, of course, bare coated distribution line. We also see for temporary pipelines installed after this date, cathodic protection is not required, or bare or ineffectively coated lines installed prior to 1971, or prior to the code, shall we say, that have no evidence of active corrosion. Now, one thing I can tell you, proving that your pipeline does not have active corrosion is not always an easy thing. You have to develop certain things to do it. What do you think, partner? Pretty difficult. We did it one time. We had some problems with hard spots, and we ran some pigs on, and the pigs checked for hard spots and corrosion on the pipeline. And what we had to do on those hard spots, it would give us an indication that it might be one. And we had to go dig it up and actually test the metal with a little tester, and then it was 50-50 usually whether it was going to be hard to where we had to put a sleeve or not too hard. Now, the thing that gave us, well, because we had low readings, the inspector come in and checked this out and said, look, y'all got low readings down here. Now, you got to understand, this is in South Texas. Now, you remember we was talking about you need electrolytes and moisture? Well, you get some dry soil, what do you got? You got low readings, don't you? Down in South Texas, it can get kind of dry. That's where the mesquite meets the rattlesnakes, okay? Now, and he says, y'all got some low reading, well, we're going to have a meeting on it. But what we were able to do, because that stretch of line, which is like 150 miles or 200 miles, we actually had dug over 700 bell holes in that stretch of pipeline, checking for those hard spots. By doing so, whenever we dug them up, we do like all you good operators. When you dig a bell hole and expose your pipe, what do, partner? you inspect it, you look for corrosion, don't you? And you make note of what you got. And most of the time, you're going to take pipe to saw, read and write it, the pipe, maybe 3 inches from the pipe, two while you're there, and take one from the top. And that kind of gets into something we call IR or drop. We're going to talk about that here in a minute. But what you got here is the ability to prove that you don't have active corrosion. It's gone. It's going to take some effort. You just can't say, well, we ain't got no corrosion there, pipe. They're not going to go with that. All right. Now, also not required for electrically isolated metal alloy fittings in plastic pipeline system, as some of you have, or pipelines in non-corrosive environments. Again, we see a way you have to prove that it is a non-corrosive environment. So you have to have some data to prove that is not existing. Okay? Now, some of the ways you can do that, you can take some of these measurements like saw resistivity. We talked about that earlier. You got some high resistive saw on the deal. You can check on whether or not you might have bacterial corrosion or might have bacteria that can cause corrosion. You have to see whether or not that may be out there. How many leaks have you had on this line? Well, we haven't had, but, you know, two leaks and both of them was tobacco, you know, that kind of thing. There was no corrosion. Well, maybe that's going to help you out. Let me back that up just a second. Soil composition, remember we talked about dissimilar soils and compaction and all that other stuff. The pH, remember we looked at that. Bell hole inspection, we talked about that, what you got to do and what you ought to do. Internal inspection, anytime you cut the pipe, what do you got to do? You got to look inside of it, don't you? What are you looking for? Corrosion. Now, don't be like my partner one time. No, he wasn't my partner. He was just a guy. I say that because we cut the pipe open and the old boy was looking inside. He said, a frog just jumped in there. And he's looking inside with a bick. A 20-inch pipeline. They run him off right there. Run him off right there. That was it. Yeah, like I said, he wasn't my partner. Didn't get a chance to be my partner. He didn't get a chance to do much else. Instead of lead that place. Anyway, you don't want to be doing that either, so hold off on the big and the open pipeline. Anyway, also post-insulation test. We put a pipeline in. Of course, we want to check the potential of saw resistivity. So we're checking to see whether or not we have a non-corrosive environment. All right. Now, criteria. We're going to get into criteria, but I think we need to tell a little story before we go any further because I can see y'all. Y'all doing all right, but you need something to help you along, a little boost there. I hope I can do it for you. You know, I told y'all yesterday about Uncle Noon and his brother-in-law.
Okay.
You remember Flounder Terrio? You remember Flounder? Both his eyes on the same side of his head. Anyway, the other night, they were down in New Orleans. How many of y'all been in New Orleans, by the way? Okay, we got several people. Well, they was walking the dog. Uncle Noah was walking the dog out there on Raw Street. And they passed one of them barroom cocktail lounge combinations that they have frequented before. And Uncle Noah, he went running up in that barroom cocktail lounge. And they got people up in there, you know, they drinking, they talking, they playing foosball, they shooting pool. You know, they're doing all the stuff you normally do in a barroom cocktail lounge. And Uncle Noon run in there and say, your attention, please. Your attention, please. Anybody know the number for 911? And the fella say, partner, you got some trouble? He say, I got some trouble. He said, well, what you got trouble with? He said, I got some trouble with the guy that owned that green pickup truck out there. With that great big dog he got up in there. He said, wait a minute. I own that green pickup out there, and that's my dog in the back of that pickup. That's a Great Dane. That's the biggest dog they make. What kind of trouble you got with me? He said, well, I got trouble with you because you got that great big Dane out there, that Great Dane, and my dog, and I was walking my dog, and my dog killed your dog. He said, whoa, man. He said, your dog killed my dog, the Great Dane, biggest dog they make? Yeah. He said, what you got out there? One of them Rottweiler? He said, no, I ain't got no Rottweiler. He said, you got one in pitting board? He said, no, I have no pitting board. You got a lavatory receiver? He said, no, I ain't got no lavatory receiver. He said, what you got? He said, I got a little chihuahua about that big. Wait a minute. He said, you trying to tell me that your little chihuahua about that big killed a great thing, the biggest dog to me? Yeah. Man, you're going to have to explain that. How in the world could a little chihuahua kill a great Dane, biggest dog to me? Say, joked on him. And I'm trying not to give you too much information you might choke on this morning. I'm trying to give it to you in a fun way, a little bit, best we can. You know, under the code, 192.463 requires cathodic protection to comply with Appendix D of the code. All right. Now, this comes from Nates, okay? Now, to do, to take readings to determine whether or not you meet some of this criteria, and let me add this. This criteria is under review, I believe, and probably going to change. We realize that under Appendix D in your code, there's five criteria, isn't there? Right, Bob? Isn't there still five? How many do you use?
One.
Most people only use one. We're going to talk a little bit about two of them. Some people do use which one? Hundred millivolt shift. The rest of them, the 300 millivolt, the TAFL. Is that the way you say that, TAFL? Oh, okay. And there's one more. Come on now. See, it's so damn bad you don't even remember it. We don't want to talk about it then. You're going to get a bad grade, though. So look it up in the Appendix D and tell us what it is. I'm going to make you use that code book. Everybody's reaching for the code. First one that gets the answer. And they're moving on. Hey, you know, y'all look like one of them crowds here to me. How many of y'all were kind of coming up in the 70s? 60s? Yeah, I thought it was you. What do you think was the most used word back then in the hippie generation?
Groovy.
No bitching.
Oh, God. what he said. No, neither one of them. Anybody?
Far out.
Far out. That's pretty good. Anybody else?
Man.
You know what the most used word in the hippie generation was? What's that?
The motion word?
The most used word.
Oh, most used.
Yeah. Now, we've had groovy and...
Yeah.
Far out.
Far out. What we had, far out. Anything else now?
Cool.
Probably peace, love, all that good stuff. No. None of that. Ear. 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 Y'all won't get that. But I see a lot of y'all did. Anyway, just thought I'd throw that in. That same fella that gave me that I'm an alcoholic thing told me that one. He's a vendor at the Kansas seminar. All right. Enough of that. That's a pretty good joke, though. Y'all find it? E-log I, wasn't it? Yeah. E-log I. That's always nice. They use a lot of that for downhole drilling, though. And nobody uses it for pipelines. Too much stuff you got to go through, okay? So we're going to see what we use, a 0.85 and 100 millivolt here in just a little bit. But we got some tools of the trade we need to kind of talk about a little bit before we get up into what we're trying to do. Of course, we got a voltmeter. Now, this could be the old analog type voltmeter, but maybe some of y'all got one of them, got that needle that floats up and down, you know. Or it could be digital. And I imagine most of y'all using digital, if not all of y'all by now, okay? half cell and some copper wire. Remember, we got to have a full circuit there. So basically what we're trying to do is take some readings on the pipeline. Now, half cell. What is a half cell? Okay, well, half cell, basically a cell, remember we talked about a corrosion cell, we talked about a flashlight cell, anode, cathode, electrolyte, right? Okay, so that's what our cell is. Now, that flashlight cell. Other examples are, of course, car batteries and things of that nature. What we've got is here, anode, cathode here, we've got a half cell to make up the other half of our circuit. Hence, we call it a half cell. And what we have here, we utilize something called copper sulfate, and it's a way of getting a consistent reading by utilizing this half cell. It's a method to insert something into the circuit. Remember we were talking about copper so much today? I know, I talked about copper, and you said, what the hell are you talking about copper? We don't have a copper gas line. You don't have any copper gas line. Do. But they use copper as a reference, and that's why we call this a reference cell, and they use copper sulfate as that reference. And you can see where copper fit in that series of metals, didn't you? Didn't you?
Yep.
No, I wanted to hear an answer from it. So anyway, don't drink this stuff. In fact, don't drink it. Don't mess with this. Don't get it on your hands and stuff, okay? Because it's extremely poisonous, okay? Because I know how you are. You get that stuff on your hand, it might get in your skin. Then you're going, which way the wind blowing today? And then, you know, all that, then you're going, we won't have you next year. We don't want that, okay? Good. Now, let's hear a little bit of explanation from my old buddy, Ed Ondike.
Well, I want to demonstrate now is the copper sulfate electrode, better known as the copper sulfate half cell. A half cell is composed of a hollow tube with a window in there. Inside, we have a copper rod. You can see the copper rod through the window. That's filled with a copper sulfate solution that is saturated. You'll see the crystals in there. Saturation simply meaning that we have more copper sulfate crystals and then they will dissolve. The bottom of the half cell itself is a porous plug, which allows the movement of the electron to go from the soil through this porous plug to complete the cell. Bear in mind that you must take the cap off the half cell in order to get a good reading. If you fail to do that, your reading's not going to be too good.
Nah. You gotta take the cap off, don't forget. Also, it has to be clean, doesn't it, partner? To get that contact with the soil.
What we're going to demonstrate now is the accuracy of the copper sulfate electrode. This particular electrode represents the working electrode, the one that you use in the field. In order to test its accuracy, you should always calibrate it against a copper sulfate electrode that is made up of a brand new half cell with clean copper sulfate solution and crystals and never used in the field. The way to calibrate it is simply put it into a container of water. Make sure that container is a non-conductive material such as glass or plastic. The reading between the two half cells should be 5 millivolts or less. If it's greater than 5 millivolts, take the working half cell, take it apart, clean the copper tube, replace the solution with clean copper sulfate solution and crystals, and then simply recalibrate and you're ready to use the half cell.
If all of y'all do that, right? Right. I see people writing here to calibrate. Okay, good. All right, now as far as the cathodic protection criteria, like I said, we do have those five that we mentioned earlier that my friend helped me out with. And we're going to just kind of focus a little bit today on the two that's really used out in the world, okay? The primary use of 850 millivolt negative 50 or 100 millivolt polarization decay. Now, we utilize our equipment, and of course, we have to understand, of course, we're looking at, we utilize to measure the current applied, considering the IR drop, and that that is another one of those things that people often ask you. I remember years ago they'd come out and ask you, are you considering IR drop when you're taking your measurement? And we go, yeah. We consider it. And really, it as far as enforcement, right now it's still kind of in limbo as far as IR drop. But I mean, it as far as practicality and what you probably should be doing is one of the things that I wish they'd nail it down a little bit more. I wish they would. But just wanted to mention that to you. And of course, we're utilizing our copper sulfate reference electrode, and this is used on land predominantly. Now, if you've got offshore, just want to mention this. I know you probably don't have a lot of offshore pipe. In salt water, they use sometimes a silver chloride half cell, and it's an 800 millivolt deal. Okay, now. You can use a copper sulfate offshore, but the reason they don't use a lot of silver chloride is the word silver. It's expensive, yeah. So you can use a copper sulfate, but you have to use like a conversion factor, you'll have to do a little math, okay? So I just want to let you know. But you guys don't have any seawater stuff, so let's get on with it. Well, basically, like I said, we have our lead, our meter, our reference cell, our electrolyte, of course, the soil. And basically, we've got our pipe. We're going to take a reading. We've got to have a connection to the pipe. Remember, it had to have that metallic path. So there's usually a test lead to the pipe, or maybe it's some other thing that's connected directly to the pipe. Okay? Some other piece of metal that's connected directly to the pipe. And some people just take a probe wire. Yeah, I know. I don't even want to talk about it. Damaging the coating and all that other stuff. IR drop, basically, what we're looking at here is Ohm's law, okay? And we learned that voltage E, is a product of the current I and the resistance R. Remember we were talking about saw resistivity and everything? So, if you've got IR that equals voltage and you reduce either one of those, what are you going to get? Less voltage, right? And you're trying to get maybe that negative 850 volts. So you can, if you're not taking into account the IR drop, that difference, then you're not really accounting for a true reading of the pipe-to-soil reading. And that's what you're trying to get. Is a pipe to soil reading and to determine if you're protecting the pipeline. Now, where did they get this 850? You know where they got it? Well, basically, steel pipe, it's natural deal, okay? It's natural potential, like 800, negative 800, okay? And there was some research done, and they figured out after the research that if you, on all metals kind of deal, if you can, like, go 50 millivolts above what that natural potential was, then you can protect that metal. So add 50 to the 800, they said that'll do it for you every time.
That'll make it a cat, though.
That'll make it good. But you got to consider that IR, you see? If you've got some soil and stuff and other things. That's not the only thing that adds to the resistance. You got the wire and you got the meter and you got a variety of things that's going to add to that resistance. So you know when we're talking about that bell hole and we dug that bell hole and I'm telling you we take a pipe to saw 3 inches from the pipe. If you're 3 inches from the pipe, you don't have a lot of soil, a lot of resistance between you and the pipe, you're real close to it. So you get kind of a true reading at that point, but you can't always take a reading there, can you? You might be 4 foot above the pipe, right? So that's what we're trying to say. We're trying to figure out a way of giving us a reading like we was close, but we're not close. We're above it. So the things that contribute to that IR drop, you have to that's going to add on to that differentiation, that incorrectness of your number is what we should say IR drop is. Test lead wire, like I said, the voltmeter has its, the cell itself and the wall of the pipe all have resistance. This here a little bit from old Ed here.
For this demonstration, we're going to show what cathodic protection actually is. In this case, I'm going to take and connect a lead from the magnesium over to the steel pipe. And notice what happens to my reading. Let me show that again. I'm taking the connection from the steel and loose. Notice the reading. It went way down. Notice what happens when I connect the magnesium. It becomes higher negative. And the half cell itself is placed right at the interface of the nail, which is what the code calls for. It says you must consider the structure of the IR drop other than that across the structure electrolyte boundary. Now imagine, if you will, as I move the half cell away from the steel, symbolizing going from the surface of the pipe to the surface of the earth, watch what happens to the voltmeter and voltage reading.
Goes from 0.75 to 0.9.
Further away from the pipe, toward the surface of the earth, notice I get a higher negative reading, which is IR drop. Also notice if I go perpendicular from the steel, moving away from it, I get a higher and higher negative reading, again symbolizing more IR drop or voltage drop in the electrolyte. That's why it's very important when you take a reading to ensure, number one, that the half cell is placed directly over the pipe, and number two, to take an instant off reading without current applied.
Okay.
Well, this demonstrates.
I don't want to hear this. Pardon me, I slipped up there. I want to see where I was at anyway. Okay, good. Okay, good. I want to see where it was on time. I'm still doing all right. From our little change there.
Wayne.
Yes, sir.
Okay, ideally, the closer you get that half cell to the pipe, the better it is, right?
Yes.
Okay, so would it be proper or feasible if a guy could take a shovel out there, maybe dig down 2 feet directly toward the pipe and put your half cell there? Is that good or not?
You mean get right next to the pipe?
You can't get right next to it, but you can dig down through the topsoil, maybe
a foot. Well, you still want to have some. You'll have less over the pipe, closer to the pipe. You still have to consider it. If you've got some really difficult soil conditions or whatever.
We do up in Montana.
Yeah, it could be still a situation where it's more than, in other words, it's overriding your accurate reading. You still have to consider the IR drop. Like I say, this is one of them things that right now, as far as I wish they had it clearer in the code, but it's one of those things we talked about yesterday. The code sometimes is a performance language, and we have guidance for it, but we don't always spell it out like we're going to, you know, nail you to the wall or something. But you have to be able to show, prudent operator judgment. Remember we talked about that, sound engineering practices and standard industry practices.
Jeff said that's why we do interrupted surveys.
That's it. You've got a circuit interrupter, and you cut the current off to get your reading so that there's no interference there. Plus, you're right over the pipe, so you're doing all the things you need to get the accurate reading like Ed was talking about. Okay, where was I? Okay, so like I said, we have a situation there, and I explained this earlier about the native potential for the steel pipe. And the study showed that if you applied 50 millivolts on top of that native potential, that's how they figured up the negative 850 volts. So you're talking about an instant off situation here where you may have been reading one thing, but when you cut off that power and you're seeing that actually you're below that 0.85 or 850 millivolt level, and you know you have to do something to bring that up. All right. Now, when you take that reading, what are you actually taking a reading of? Okay. Well, basically, you got our meter, you got the half cell, you got these little holidays in the pipe. For some of you who don't know what holidays is, it's places on the pipe that may not have coating. Okay. In other words, it's void of any coating or protection. So those are the places that could actually corrode. Okay, they're not coated and protected with coating. So you're actually reading an average of the pipe to saw voltages through those holidays that may be small places of coating interruption on the pipe. Now, if you had a perfect coating, if you had a really good coating, like I'm sure you have on your pipeline, and you have, I'm sure, if you had a perfect coating, what would the reading be?
It'd be perfect.
It'd be perfect. Zero. It'd be zero. Because if you had a perfect coating, there would be nothing coming from those soil potentials of those holidays. It wouldn't have any holidays, you see? So you'd have a reading of zero. But what you're actually getting is an average of those pipe to saw. If you get a negative 0.85 volts reading, okay, is that sufficient, do you think, to protect against the holidays? Well, you think, well, yeah, you just told me that, guy, that negative 0.85 is enough to protect it. But the thing you have to consider is one of these holidays is giving you a negative 1.05, and another one is giving you a negative 0.65, okay? So that's how you got the average. So are you protecting both of these equally? Maybe you need to consider that negative 0.85 in some cases, depending on the pipeline, you need to have more protection. So sometimes it's just not a good idea to do the minimum, okay? Here's that current interrupter that you talked about. Sometimes that's also used for the 100 millivolt polarization decay. Do you also use that? Anybody use that here? Y'all do. Had to have two people using that thing. I could have skipped over this and just went on. But anyway, like I said, it's not something that's used by a lot of folks, but I'm going to turn this over to our experts. Anyway, basically, though, you're using the same tools, right, sir?
Yep.
Okay, but you're using that circuit interrupter. And pretty much your negative 100 millivolt polarization decay criteria, you're momentarily interrupting the current, and you're measuring, remember we talked about polarization, you're measuring the decay of that polarization, okay, within the saw, between the pipeline and the reference half cell, the reference electrode. And while it's interrupted, there's an immediate volt shift in there. Because of an IR drop, we see an immediate drop, and then from that immediate drop, it's going to decay, and it should happen within 48 hours. Anything past that is not good. So it should be at least 100 millivolts of additional decay. Is that correct? What say? I think so. That's good. That's good. What about you, partner?
I think so too.
Okay. Well, I got two think so's. How about the rest of y'all? Don't give a damn. Okay. Good. All right. Monitoring. Okay. Before we get into monitoring, I really need to wake y'all up a little bit because I can see y'all not gonna have lunch. You're thinking about we're not gonna have lunch. Maybe we'll have a piece of old bagel or something there, something like that. We gotta throw something in there. I just realized I didn't talk about Cuckoo Seminole. Did I mention Cuckoo Seminole?
Why don't we call that?
Oh, man, let me tell you. You know, I was looking at my partner here, Nathan And it got me to thinking, you know, having a government job like we got, you know, Cuckoo Seminole down in South Louisiana, he's one of them guys, his alligators don't go all the way to the top floor. He's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, you know. He's like two beers shy of a six-pack, you know. Not, you didn't remind me of that. It was the government job. That's what you know what I'm saying. But anyway, Cuckoo wanted to get a government job. They had a deputy job, be exact, working for the sheriff. And they had an opening, so he went over to the sheriff's office. And, you know, he figured he had a chance because he's the sheriff's cousin.
All right.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes, I don't know if that works up here in South Dakota, but, you know, sometimes if you kinfolk, you might get a job somewhere, you know? But anyway, down in Louisiana, it worked pretty good. But the sheriff, he's a good man, and he don't go in for that kind of stuff. He wants the good people working for him, just like Nathan. And he come out there, and they had two other fellas that was going in for the job with Cuckoo. And the sheriff told his assistant, he said, now I want you to send in each one individually. I'm going to ask them a question, and then we're going to see who has the best answer. That's who gets the job. So, says send in the first applicant. So sure enough, they sent in the first fella. The sheriff says, sit down. He said, who shot Abraham Lincoln? He said, John Wilkes Booth. He said, that's right. He said, send in the next fella. So the fella went out and he sent in the next guy. He said, sit down, partner. Say, who shot Abraham Lincoln? John Wilkes Booth. Said, that's right. Send Cuckoo in here. Cuckoo come in there. Said, sit down, Cuckoo. Sheriff say, who shot Abraham Lincoln? Cuckoo say, I kind of scratchy head. Sheriff, it's Friday. Could I come back in on Monday with the answer to that? Oh, he said, yeah, that's no problem. That's no problem. He said, that'd be fine. So, Aunt Cuckoo, he goes home. And his wife, Lurleen, she's waiting at the house. How'd it go? How'd the interview go? Did you get the job? He said, get the job? They got me working a murder case already. Man, Cuckoo the other night showed up at the funeral parlor. Cuckoo showed up at the funeral parlor, and the funeral director seen him open the door, and he's standing there with white fur. White fur from the top of his head to the tip of his toes. He's got white fur put on him. He's got black shoe polish on his nose. Man, the funeral director said, what in the world? Cuckoo said, you got T-Boy Boudreaux laid out here dead? He said, yeah, I got T-Boy back in the back there. He said, well, he's a real good friend of mine. In fact, his wife told me she wanted me to be a polar bear at the funeral. All right. Anyway. Let's go on with monitoring. Basically, on the 465A through A and C, we need to monitor our cathodically protected areas, isolated sections of gas mains for you good folks out there, less than 100 foot gas main transmission using a 10% sampling per year. So this kind of narrows it down, gives you some leeway there. And of course, the non-critical bonds. And these need to be done once each calendar year. That's not one of our old favorites, inspection frequencies in the code. Once each calendar year, not to exceed 15 months. Additionally, we need to look at rectifiers and switches and diodes and critical bonds and reverse currents. What is that, six times a year? Intervals not to exceed 2.5 months. So we go out there and check those rectifiers we saw and those bonds. We'll take a look at some areas where we put some of those bonds in areas. We have an area that might be in some interference area going here. We've got our protected pipeline and another structure. It could be another pipeline or some other metallic object that's under the ground and there could be some interference going on here. Anybody have a situation like that? You have, sir? What do y'all do there?
You could try to bond.
A bond. And what does a bond do for you? It alleviates this, doesn't it?
Gives it a path.
And it protects it. So you're not like eating somebody else's pipeline up with yours or vice versa because of the differences in the two structures. Okay, good. Here's another area. Like I said, you could have another situation where corrosion could occur because of the proximity of these two facilities. And we need to monitor those, and especially if we put those bonds in between them. Additionally, we need to see if we got some unprotected pipelines out there, and some people do. You got to check those little puppies about every 3 years, okay? But they changed it a few years ago. They put it to where not to exceed 39 months. You know, this used to be one of them things where they put every 3 years. Man, and every 3 years you got to that date. Let's just say it was September the 1st. Well, hell, you had to get it done by September the 1st. Well, suppose September the 1st was on a Sunday. Well, hell, you'd have to get it done right by August 29th, wouldn't you? Right? And then next year, what you'd have to do? Yeah, but if that was on a Sunday, wouldn't you have to back it up some more, wouldn't you? Well, they finally realized, this ain't too smart. We need to give these people some flexibility like we do with the old... you know, once each calendar year, not to exceed 15 months. So they chunked in there about that 39 months, give you some flexibility there, and where you could kind of keep that date going. Now, determine those areas of active corrosion, electrical survey, corrosion, leak history, and that's always important to maintain a knowledge of these things, helping our monitoring of cathodic protection and corrosion especially. And if you expose the pipe, you should have some inspection records. We used to have some bell hole inspection records and things of this nature. And, of course, knowledge and records on the pipeline environment that's out there. Active corrosion, well, we talked a little bit about that a while ago. And basically, that's what we consider, by definition, continuing corrosion, that if you let it go, it could be detrimental to the public safety. That's a key thing there. Detrimental to the public safety. This was changed from 457C to 465E a few years ago. Now, what do we mean detrimental to the public safety? Well, it's in a place where you got a lot of folks living. Maybe your population's pretty thick there. Or maybe this is where you got road crossing area. The pressures are high pressures and things of that nature that could really affect them if it blew out because of corrosion and things of that nature. And, of course, we're looking at the corrosion rate that we're looking at on those three-year intervals. Remember, we talked about just a minute ago those inspections there. So, additionally, we have to do electrical survey. And a series of pipe-to-soil readings, that's using our half-cell, using our meter and things. And we're analyzing, we're trying to check those areas where that corrosive current, remember that current we're talking about, is actually leaving the pipeline. We want to protect that pipeline. We don't want this stuff to be happening. Some of those areas that we want to look at in our electrical surveys, remember we talked about some of the areas where they're going under a pavement and stuff. Well, hell, some of these places you got wall-to-wall pavement, especially at Walmart, right? I ain't going to use that joke again. Golly, I know. And I thought I'd throw in a little humor, but I don't know how little it was. I wasn't throwing it in. Anyway, wall-to-wall pavement, it's hard to get pipe saw through concrete, isn't it? A lot of times, do y'all use any like areas where you actually leave a little place to take the pipe to saw in a paved area? Anybody? Got a man shaking his head out there. Yeah. Okay. Who'll give me two? Who'll give me three? I like his signal. He's looking like a guy at an auction. Yeah, I'll buy it. Anyway, areas where we have straight currents, and we saw this situation a while ago when we in one of our depictions, and of course pipeline cover in and out of pavement. Like driveways and pavement here and roadways and things in this area. Pipeline environment, of course, we have to consider that. We're looking at that resistivity, whether it's low or high, that moisture in the soil. Remember, I told about South Texas, how dry it is down there. All these things play a part on what kind of readings we're going to be getting. You may have some soil contaminants out there. Hell, Johnny might have dumped a load of acid on your pipeline. You don't know. And that could change the pH and other things in the soil. And all other known conditions, because you have your own little situation in different parts of your state or different parts of your system that you know can cause you problems in the pipeline environment. Basically, we need to remember, according to the code 192.459, that's how we, like I said earlier, if we dig it up, we got to look at it. We got to examine it. We got to look at it longitudinally, circumferentially, check this pipe out. If we find something, what do we got to do? Yeah, but what else? We document it. That's very good. I like that, document it. But also, what else? We got to keep looking. You know, you got to look a little further. Yeah, you know, if your bell hole's just, you know, 8 feet long and you find, man, this whole damn thing eat up. You know, I think we need to dig a little bit further to see if this is just an isolated thing, and then you got to kind of decide, you know, once you get to some good pipe, which I know is hard for you guys. Anyway, little. Regulatory humor. Very little, yeah. You're a lot of help. Anyway, when we expose it, we check the pipe for the condition of the pipe. See if anybody dug in the pipe or damaged it in any way. Of course, we're concerned also with the coating that protects the pipe. Exposed pipeline, we're investigating, like I said, whether the corrosion or the coating deterioration. A lot of times, maybe the coating. You know, some of these old coatings, I mean, they're deteriorated. They're breaking down. They're allowing water to get up between the coating and the pipe and things. This stuff can cause some problems. And, of course, we talked about the hydrogen embrittlement and ions of hydrogen. Electrons of hydrogen going onto the pipe. If you find it, like I said, you got to look for it. You got to repair it. And you said the right word. You got to keep records. The monitoring period, basically remedial actions, usually, and I'm not sure about your state, this is probably the same thing. If you find something, that before the next monitoring deal, you have to get it fixed. Now, some states is different. I just want to let you know that. Like in Louisiana, for one state, you take a pipe to soil reading, you don't have a year, not to exceed 15 months to get it fixed. You got 90 days. See, their regulations are more stringent than the federal code. So anything you find is 90 days or the inspection period. Okay? Monitoring period. Whichever is less. You see what I'm talking about? So if it's a year, they only allow you 90 days. So I'm just saying, I'm just letting you know that there are other places. Maybe you have pipelines in different states. So if you do, you need to know what the state requirements are because they can be more stringent. It should be prompt, though. I mean, you consider what you're doing here. You're looking at your pipeline, your asset in the ground. You want to take good care of it. And also, you need to consider and establish so that this is what we've looked at to determine which one of these little puppies we're going to take care of. We got 4 or 5 places that's got some problems. Similar problems, we're going to address them in a way, looking at population density, environmental concerns, you know, where it could hurt the most, rate of corrosion, climatic conditions, availability of materials. We had those hard spots that I talked about earlier and things we run in corrosion pigs and hard spot pigs. We developed a plan to where we had a bunch of these things. I'm only talking about a pipeline that was like 800 miles long, okay, went through 2 states. So we had to develop a plan on how we're going to attack this problem and sleeve it, remedial action, okay? Now, what we did was we developed this plan where we would go to the highest population areas, class 3 and was the highest on this particular pipeline, and we would go to the roads in those, because that's where you have to patrol the most frequently when you're patrolling. We go to the roads in the class 3, and get all those done, and then go to the class 3, and then the roads in the class 2. You know what I'm talking about? The place where you were required by the code to do things more often, we attack first, okay? And we ran that plan by the federal inspectors who are jurisdictional to say, what do you think? Can we do it any better? So in other words, that was that thing I was talking about yesterday, making you know, kind of getting some input on these things, because you don't want to just be, you know, a lone ranger out there. Okay, electrical isolation. Now, I know a bunch of you probably have some. Anybody got case pipelines? Casing. Okay, yeah. Well, normally when we talk about electrical isolation, a lot of times we're talking about casing, but I think we talked about a while ago maybe some adjacent metals that might be touching the thing. Basically, we're trying to isolate the pipeline from other underground structures. Usually, it's casing that people are considering. And here we see a casing, a pipeline going through the casing, a casing seal that's put up there to what? Try to keep water out, doesn't it? Right? And also, there will be some little devices up in there, little centering cradles and things like that to keep it from touching the inside of the casing. Well, what happens sometimes, it flexes a little bit, or one of them old centering plastic cradles or whatever they're made out of, you know, they'll break or something like that. And what happens? The pipe touches the casing, and we get what's called a shorted casing. Also, we may have a situation where we have ineffective insulation. We don't want arcing to occur in the deal. I remember when we used to install these things, casing and piping casing, before they gave us those little, now this is years ago, before they gave us those little meters where you check for continuity to see if it's touching.
Call it home meter.
No, welding rig.
Welding?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you just clamp on it a vent there. If she don't arc, you're good, eh? We stopped doing it. I'm not saying it whether it ever worked, okay? Right? Yeah, you welders know what I'm talking about. Anyway, we've got to do a shorted casing. Basically, what happens if you're going out there and take a pipe of saw reading, and then you take a casing to saw reading, you know, taking a reading on the casing like you wore a pipe connected to the casing. And if they are essentially the same, the pipe saw and the casing of saw at that place, then that means it's probably shorted. It means it's probably touching somewhere up in there. And there's some other tests that you can actually take, electrical tests that you can actually figure out about where inside that casing that short is occurring. All right. Now, we can clear the short as a remedial measure, or we can fill that space, that annular space around the pipe and inside of the casing with some kind of a dielectric material that doesn't conduct electricity, okay? Wax. People have used wax, some other materials. I remember we used to use something called black magic years ago. It was a liquid that tended to leach out into the ditch. That's another story. We won't go into that. You don't want to. One or two impractical. If you can't do these, in other words, there is a letter out there, I think, from Cesar de Leon, one of the old DOT guys. And I don't know how you feel about this. You can express yourself. Monitor with gas detection instruments at those road crossings at the intervals specified for patrolling for roads, checking the road crossings for transmission and distribution line. Or you can smart pig. Is that allowed? Is all three of these allowed in this state?
We adopt federal regulations.
You the man. I like that. Okay, good. So those are your options. Now, as far as those test leads are concerned, you have to have sufficient test leads, basically, to determine that you have adequate protection. There's not really all. You got to have 10 of them. You got to have one. Now, some folks kind of proffer they'd like to see one every mile or every line of sight, and all. You get all kinds of stuff. But basically, you got to have enough to where you can determine the adequacy of protection. Now, you know, you got a super good coated line. That's going to be different from a line that's not coated very well, isn't it? So those things are going to play a big part on being able to do that. Now, as far as the test leads themselves, attaching those puppies, let me move this thing a little bit. Go on mine here. Okay, why isn't that moving? Okay, good. Bear with me a second. When you attach those things, you don't just, I mean, you're going to use, they got some new things out there now. We used to use a CAD wheel. How many of y'all are using CAD wheel? And we saw that on this deal here. Basically, you kind of make a spot on the pipe and you clear it off and you get that coating off and you get it down to clean metal and you got this instrument that actually welds it by lighting off this. It kind of reminds you of an old flintlock gun, you know, and it fires off and the wires welded to the pipe. And then you coat that real good because you better coat it. What's that wire made out of, partner?
Copper.
Now, if you leave that wire bare and that metal bare there and you don't do a good job of coating it, what you got there? You got steel and copper. Now, which one's going to eat up for the other one?
Steel
going to eat up for the copper, isn't it? Yeah. Or vice versa, that could have some other deal that's going to eat up the copper. So one of the things going to get eat up, and then you get eat up, you know, because you'll kick yourself and things like that. Anyway, so you want to coat it, make sure it's a good connection. Also, usually they wrap it around the pipe, tie it off, because you don't want the stresses of the soil, the backfill, pulling on the well itself. So you kind of wrap it around there and have a little extra wire there so that it can be secured mechanically and electrically conductive. By the way, that was a guy putting a CAD wheel on right there. It does kind of flash like that. Smells good, too. Yeah. That might like the smell of it. Huh? No, thermite. Anyway, internal corrosion control on the 192-475. If you've got your gas or your has a corrosive property, something in it. Maybe it's got some, maybe it's got a trace of O2. Maybe it's got some liquids entrained in the gas stream. Maybe you've got some kind of H2S. I don't know if y'all got any H2S up there. Anybody? You got it all, man. I'll tell you, I'm proud of you. Sorry. Okay. You may have a product that's corrosive. So, you need to test to determine if it has an effect on your pipeline, and you probably know that by now. And if so, you need to take steps to minimize the effect of internal corrosion on a pipeline. Do you have to do any kind of remedial measures there or precautionary measures?
Use corrosion chemicals.
Okay, so you inject chemicals into the pipe so that you can kind of bathe or get some of that up inside the pipe to minimize the effect of the gas corrosivity. Anytime you cut the pipe, of course, and anytime anybody cuts the pipe, you need to inspect inside the pipe and say, wow, we got some internal corrosion here. We need to find out what's causing it and see if we've got to do like he's doing and have a program to try to mitigate this internal corrosion. If it's severe enough, you may need to replace the pipe, and that might be your remedial measure. So the monitoring of the internal corrosion, of course, under 477, you monitor it for internal corrosion twice each calendar year. Not to see 7.5 punch, you've got to get out there and check it. So, are you using coupons? Coupons are little, sometimes they're discs or they're cylinders, a little bit of piece of metal that we have a knowledge of how much they weigh prior to utilizing them. We install them into the pipeline. We pull them out. We send to a laboratory. They weigh them, and they say how much metal loss. That gives an indication of the metal loss inside of your pipeline. So the coupons are just little test deals to be able to do that with. And maybe also something that you're doing with water analysis to check the water in the gas stream to see if it has a corrosive byproducts in it, or maybe what you're doing is negating that if it's a pH kind of thing also. Bacteria, we talked about that earlier. Maybe you have to take a microbiological analysis, and of course the use of inhibitors as he talked about earlier. Atmospheric corrosion, well basically that's the pipe that's above the ground. We're trying to, and I say above the ground, and let me reiterate, sometimes there has been atmospheric corrosion, believe it or not, inside of a casing. The pipe inside of a casing. What happens, that water does get in there, and maybe that casing isn't coated real well. And the water goes up and down. You know how water does in the ground when it goes up and down inside the casing. And sometimes the air is exposed to the air, and corrosion occurs inside of a casing. So atmospheric corrosion is difficult to check inside a casing. But most of the time what we're doing, we're checking above ground pipe, and we're making sure that it's clean. We're making sure that it's coated, painted, jacketed, whatever you want to call it, suitable material for the location. We had one place that was like a, oh, you got your hand up there, probably your neck bothering you, or need me to rub it? Thank you. Anyway, we had one location, it was a paper mill. I don't know if anybody been around a paper mill. Yeah, they stink. But it's also an acrid smell, isn't it? And it's acrid because it's bad. It's like caustic. And a meter run in there, bad. You got to coat that stuff with a certain kind of paint. Because you look at some of these places, you look at these trucks running around. Are you a paper mill guy? You?
Yes.
No, I thought you looked like a paper mill guy, you know. Big, tall guy, you know, works hard. Anyway. Smells. No. Not just that. Anyway. We had to really clean this stuff really well, you know, sandblast, all this stuff. And because you look, there was trucks running around. I was 2 years old, didn't have no fenders and nothing else but a frame. Eat off. All the people that worked there every day, when they left the paper mill, they had to drive through a little car wash. And what they did was they gave them like two bottles of vinegar. They poured into this container there that the water ran through, picked up the vinegar, and they'd rinse off their automobiles from this stuff that had gotten on while parked there. So it wouldn't eat up their cars. So you know what it's doing to our above ground piping. So it has to be a suitable material that it has to be coated, okay? So that's what I'm trying to tell you. Unless it's a non-corrosive environment, and in that case, you may have a situation where you might have a meter run or something, and it's got a light surface oxide. It's not pitted. And some people claim that it actually protects the pipe from that pitting type of corrosion. So that's allowed. And normally, it used to be we'd paint every damn thing it was. But if you got a choice between a light surface oxide and you got this other deal that's pitted over here, what do you want to spend your time and money right now? On the one that's pitted. That's right. So this is kind of allowing you to do that. All right. So we look at atmospheric corrosion under 479, non-corrosive environment. This isn't applicable to your offshore splash zone, so y'all don't have to worry about it. But it is a... It's also a situation you're not applicable to your soil-to-air interface. You know where that riser comes out of the ground? You know, at a meter run or some above-ground pipe, and it comes out of the ground. And a lot of folks had that old tape. You know that tape they used years ago, and they had it really pretty wrapped up there. And they'd come up from down below the ground, and they'd come up about this high, and it's pretty, isn't it? Have you ever pulled that tape back? They tell you, a lot of times, it ain't pretty what you see up under there. And you pull that tape back, check that air to soil interface, and you find maybe some bad pits and stuff, moisture done collected up in there. You had that place where cathodic protection works below the soil, right? But it doesn't work above the soil because there's no electrolyte there, no soil. See what I'm talking about? So you don't have a good battery up there. You've got atmospheric stuff. So you're at that place where he can't decide what he wants to do, so it just is damn rust. So you want to check that out and see how it's working for you. I highly advise you to put that on your list of atmospheric corrosion areas and maybe use some specialized. They have some wax coatings there that are really good at those particular areas. Now, onshore atmospheric corrosion. On 481, we got to check this puppy every 3 years, not to see 39 months. Offshore, a little different. We got to do it more frequently. That old once each calendar year deal. All right. Monitoring those aerosol interfaces under any thermal insulation that you might have, under disbonded coating. Remember we talked about sometimes the coating has separated from the pipe. Maybe for one reason or another, the old coating. Maybe it's but you put too much power to it and disbonded the coating. That happens too at the pipe supports, blast zones offshore, deck penetrations when you're offshore, maybe even in the lake somewhere, spans over water. You might have piping that just sits in a place where water collects every now and then, a kind of wet area, marshy area. That's one of some of the places you need to look at. It may surprise you what you find. Additionally, any remedial measures, you may have to replace the pipe because of external corrosion. You have to clean it, coat it, cathodically protect it. Atmospherically, we have to do it, coating and check it out. General corrosion, on the 485, like I said, you got that bad eat-up corrosion, that general pitting. It may be bad enough if you do the calculations on how deep the pits are, how far they are apart. You do your R-string calculation or some other reliable method, you determine you don't have enough strength in this pipe wall to support the pressure you're holding. You're going to have to lower the MAOP or replace or repair the pipe if possible. Okay? Localized corrosion pitting, you may have to replace, you may have to repair, you may have to reduce the operating pressure. I don't know about you guys, but our company, if we had a pit that was 80% wall loss, we treated it like a leak. Because it's going to be one, isn't it? So if you find a pit that's 80% wall off, you might as well just go ahead and treat it like a leak and do everything you do for a leak and just go ahead and fix it right then, because you're going to be back and it won't be too long comparatively. All right, additionally, on the transmission line, on the 485, general corrosion, you get that strength, you know, the pitting that affects the strength of the pipe, localized corrosion pitting. You can utilize, like I said, that arc strength, remaining strength calculations, or the gas piping technology committee calculations. Gas distribution, 192.487, general corrosion, or wall thickness less than 30% remaining, replace or repair. Localized corrosion, those little corrosion pits, repair or replace, okay? Cast iron, how many got cast iron? Anybody got cast iron here? Man, you got everything. Golly, it's that same fellow over there. See here? You visit him a lot? Are you in South Dakota or North Dakota?
South Dakota.
Okay, bud. Yeah. You know his name, don't you?
Yep.
Yeah, I knew you knew his name. Yeah, you got him in your Rolodex. I know that. That's for sure. Anyway, cast iron, of course, you're concerned with some other things. A fracture might result. You may have to do some replacement in that particular case. A localized leak might result. Repair, replace, or do some sealing internally. Okay? That's some good-looking stuff. You're looking that good?
His desk here, and it's his area.
Yeah. He don't want to say one way or another. Okay, we understand. Corrosion control records, we got to maintain the records, right, folks? We got to have the map, don't we? Okay. One of the things, if we don't have the paperwork, we can't show it. The location of protected pipe, we mentioned that earlier, the cathodic protection facility, the ground beds, the rectifiers, all that good stuff. Where's those galvanic anodes? Bonds to other structures, underground pipelines, or other structures that we got bonds in between. Corrosion control records. Some of the records, it varies. On 491, there's some records that we have to retain for the life of pipe. The tests, the service, the inspections, they're required under subpart I. We got to retain those for 5 years. Specified exceptions. And sometimes if you check with your attorneys and they say, well, you know, we had that blowout and we're still in litigation. So we really need to keep these longer than 5 years. So those cases, some of these cases, you have to get out there and keep it a little longer because your internal requirements cause you to do so. Additionally, on the 4191C, the exceptions are as far as the life retention here, annual pipe saw surveys on the 465A, 3-year reevaluation, so 465E, and the internal inspection for corrosion on the 475B. All right. 5 minutes over, sorry. I think. Was that it?
Yeah.